Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Today's podcast is presented by Podgo. Podgo is the easiest way for you to monetize your podcast, providing podcasters with a flat rate for ad space so you always know how much you get when you include an ad from Podgo. I recently joined as a member and you can too. Apply today to become a member and immediately be connected with advertisers that fit your audience. That's podgo.co at podgo.co. And remember to include the name The Scoreless Thriller Podcast in your application. Thank you.
Man there trying to stop Drunk but getting himself into further trouble.
It's a fucking disgrace.
Oh, it's not a bad ball for Pelle on the right side. It's Carlos Alberto. Oh, what a great goal that was! Carlos Alberto!
Maradona just walked away from Hoddle then. Maldano smokes and
Argentina the lead. The England players protesting to the referee.
Half finale komen. Ik heb opeens zo'n gevoel dat we in de halve finale gaan komen. Met het balbezit voor Frank de Boer. Frank de Boer speelt de bal. Heel goed naar Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp neemt de bal aan. Dennis Bergkamp.
Dennis Bergkamp.
So hello and welcome to the Scoreless Thriller podcast. I'm Alex and I'm joined as always by Leon. Leon, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Happy to be here.
And we're joined by Connor O'Keefe, who is a professional footballer in Sweden, who's played also in Spain and in Gibraltar and previously in England. And we're delighted to have you on the podcast, Connor. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, guys. I'm excited to be here.
So Connor plays for Pitya in Sweden. Which is in, so last year you were promoted from basically the fourth tier of Swedish football into the third tier. So yeah. And so you've been in playing in Sweden for almost a year now, would you say? Or
I came here in July of 2020. So I've been here about 6 months now, but the seasons run slightly differently. So normally the Swedish season is April to November. So I joined for kind of the latter half of last season. And then I'm currently in pre-season now for the 2021 season.
So I guess my first question would be, is as two people who have moved to Denmark and have struggled with the Danish language, how is the Swedish coming along?
Yeah, it's a really tough language. I mean, I've had, fortunately, experiences of learning language with football before. Like you said, being in Spain, when I was in Spain, very few people spoke English at the club I was at, so I was almost forced to learn very quickly. But when I came to Sweden, I'm sure you guys will have probably experienced the same. Everyone's English was superb. All the coaches, all the players, their English was fantastic, which was almost a detriment to me learning Swedish because they were so good at English. It was almost like I was back at home. So I forced myself to try my best. I'm on Duolingo at the minute and desperately trying to find more established language classes to go to. But I'm getting there very slowly.
Yeah. The Danish Duolingo always gives you like animal names first, which is somewhat intriguing and interesting, but also not very, you know, applicable to everyday conversations.
I say that to all my coaches and my teammates. They're always asking about my Swedish, and I said, well, I can tell you how to say I like sandwiches or there's a moose or something like that, but I can't really talk anything more kind of conversational Swedish.
Yeah. Well, I like sandwiches. That's something that you can use. Yeah. that's quality information to convey, I guess.
Yeah. It would be a shame if you actually didn't like sandwiches. It would be difficult.
Yeah.
I've got one question, though, because we talked about already about leagues in Sweden. Because in Denmark, it appears that Division 3 is League 4. Right?
Yeah.
They
split them up by region.
Yeah, exactly. So does the same apply to Sweden?
Yeah, so last year, the fourth tier that you mentioned that we won last year is actually called Division 2. So even more kind of different in terms of the name. Yeah, so we've technically gone into Division 1, which is the third tier. So we still have Superettan and then Allsvenskan above us. So yeah, confusing names, but yeah, just we stick to the fourth tier, third tier. That's easier to track.
Also, quite to your advantage right now, right? It sounds so nice. I'm playing in Division 1. That's everyone. What more do you want?
That's true. For anyone that doesn't know Swedish football, you can flex a bit.
Yeah.
So let's wind the clock back a bit. So you started your career at Macclesfield and going through there, and then you went to university to study at Loughborough. What motivated you to sort of go back and to focus on studying rather than exclusively on the football?
Well, I played football, obviously, from a young age, but I enjoyed school at the same time. I was good at school. I enjoyed studying different subjects. I was interested in lots of things as a kid. And I was fortunate that at Macclesfield, whilst I did my kind of youth team scholarship as an apprentice, normally you leave school at 16. That's kind of the process of becoming a professional footballer in England. But I was allowed by the club and by my school to continue with my A-levels. So I did my youth team scholarship whilst studying for my A-levels from 16 to 18. I was then offered a professional contract. I started as a professional for the first time at 18, 19. And I was a third choice keeper, didn't play very often, probably didn't do as much extra curriculum practice and training in order to try and break into the first team as I should have done. And I realized how difficult it would be to try and become a first team goalkeeper at that level. Because I'd done my A-levels, I had an offer from Loughborough, having done the UCAS application process. I never really wanted to go to university. It was never in my mind. I always wanted to be a professional footballer, but my mum and dad encouraged me to go and have a look at Loughborough, go and see the football program. And I'm very glad that they did, because for those of you that know kind of Loughborough University, it's probably the best sporting university in the UK. It's the home of British athletics, British swimming. The facilities are incredible. The football program is almost like a full-time football club. We had strength and conditioning coaches, physios, nutritionists, psychologists, and we were almost full-time players alongside studying for a degree. So once I saw kind of the benefit that it would bring me as a footballer, first and foremost, which is strange to say when talking about university, whilst also enabling me to study something that I was interested in, which was an international business course, and having had the experience of combining studying and sport before as a younger person, it was a really good opportunity for me to keep progressing on all those fronts. So a strange decision in terms of the status quo of progressing through football, but one that helped me to develop as a player and a person. So one I'm very glad to have taken, really.
And during the third year of your studies, you spent it in Madrid. And I read that you, when you went to Madrid, you like drove around to every single club in the city to try and get a trial with them. So, and that's how you ended up with the, what was it, Fuenlabrada,
yeah.
Sorry. So, Fuenlabrada.
Why did you give up so early?
Just I was probably kind of coming.
Yeah, just let it out.
I know, it's so bad because I actually speak a bit of Spanish from now.
Oh, yeah, but this is the golden letter story, right?
Yeah. This is it, yeah. My third year, I had the choice to either do an Erasmus year and study abroad or to go and work in industry or do a placement year. And my aim was still to progress with my football, and working full time would obviously make that more difficult. So I took the opportunity to study abroad. I had always watched Spanish football growing up. It was something I always enjoyed. So the opportunity to go to Spain and try and find a team was a really exciting opportunity. But I didn't speak Spanish. I didn't have an agent. I didn't know any Spanish coaches or anything. So I almost had to take it upon myself to be my own agent and try and contact as many clubs in the area that I was going to be living and studying in as I could. So my girlfriend helped a lot. She spoke Spanish, and she helped to translate a lot of letters for me, where I kind of wrote out who I was, where I'd been, my, like, the links to my highlight videos and things. And yeah, we literally took a plane to Madrid, hired a car, and drove around all the clubs that we could find, from the top teams all the way down to kind of eighth, ninth tier teams. So eventually we were very fortunate that I ended up at Fuenlabrada, who were a really good club. They were in the third division at the time, now in the second division in Spain. And again, I joined them with their first team. I was a third choice goalkeeper, but training full time, learning Spanish, developing my game in a sense that I hadn't been exposed to with English football whilst doing my Erasmus year. But I think anyone that's done an Erasmus year knows it's quite light in terms of volume. So it was pretty much just all focused on the football. So it was a great experience for me, and kind of culminated in a really cool trip to the Bernabeu to face Real Madrid in the Copa del Rey. We had them home and away. So being part of a squad at the Bernabeu was something incredible as well. So it was an amazing year.
What was it like preparing to play Real Madrid? Like, was there a massive change in sort of people's focus in training or stuff, or did people try and just like...
We had a team that was very experienced. We had a lot of players who had played in La Liga. We had a couple of players that had played for Real Madrid and had played for Atletico Madrid. So they kind of led it in a sense that they were kind of very consistent. For myself, I was in an almost privileged position where I knew I wasn't really going to play because I was third choice. I was the young goalkeeper. So for me, it was just just soak it all in, be a sponge, learn as much as you can, enjoy it. So yeah, from having nobody at training to suddenly 30, 40 cameras and journalists watching all our training sessions, and then the trip to the Bernabeu itself and things like that, it was an incredible experience.
But also before, like, so daring the move that you would just, you know, go to all the clubs, ask them whether they would allow you to join training sessions and whatever. Were there any social awkward moments where someone was like, why is this English lad coming here? And
very, yeah, a few. I mean, the majority of people were quite understanding. I think once they realised that I wasn't just kind of some crazy kid that just liked football and had actually had some kind of professional level experience, they kind of opened up a little bit more. But there was one, we went
How
to one
How do you convey
club.
This, though, that you're like a professional? Like, cause
I was lucky that my girlfriend spoke Spanish, because again, my minimal Spanish, like we said, I probably would have only been able to say I like sandwiches in Spanish or whatever it was at that point.
So like goalkeeper. yeah.
But there was one club we went to, and I don't think he was the manager. I think he was an assistant manager or something, but he was he was almost aggressive in trying to usher us out the door and calling us all sorts of names and stuff. But you just tick it off the list and go to the next one.
Yeah. When you went into the stadium in Madrid, was there anything that, like, any specific moment that you cling on to that stuck out? Or was it just like the whole experience?
Mm. Yeah. I mean, there was a few things. I think when we arrived on the coach, we were coming through the streets of Madrid, and I mean, it was by no means a full stadium. It's a cup game against a lower league team. It looked empty, but I think there was probably about 60,000 people there. But because the stadium is 80,000-90,000, you see all these empty seats. But coming into the stadium, you see all the crowd coming towards the stadium and obviously coming in and putting fingers up at the bus and all that kind of stuff. So that was quite funny. We had a police escort to get there. And once you got off the bus, like you see when you watch the Champions League, you kind of see the cameras there and they're filming the players get off the bus. And suddenly you're one of those players and they're filming you get off the bus and you're trying to look like you've belong there and that you've always done this before and you're not actually really going crazy in your head.
Did you buy some new Dre Beats headphones just for the occasion?
It's funny, a lot of the pros obviously had the big headphones, had the little wash bag. I think I had like my flipping Nike drawstring bag with my boots in, and that was all I had, and I was just toddling along. And then when we got to kind of the entrance, the players' entrance, the guy holding the door open was Raul, like welcoming us all and like saying hi, and you're kind of thinking, wow. And then you walk out into the stadium itself, the Bernabeu tunnel, a lot of people will kind of remember it from seeing it on TV, is a very long tunnel which is quite deep with metal grating down the middle, which separates the home and away teams as they come out. And then you have to climb these stairs to get onto the pitch itself. And all you can see is the lights from the floodlights and the stands. And the stands seem to go on forever, that you can't see the sky because the stands are so tall. It's such a deep stadium and such a tall kind of almost five tiers all the way around that it feels like a real amphitheater of football. So walking out onto that pitch and seeing those stands and all that kind of stuff, and then looking across and seeing Bale warm up and Keylor Navas and Zidane walking down the touchline, you're kind of like, wow, okay, that's very cool.
Yeah, because I think you took the team took the lead, right, in Bernabeu in the league.
Yeah, we went 1-0 up, and it was a great goal. If anyone goes back and watch the highlights, it was a really good game. We went 1-0 up with a really good goal, and I think we were winning 1-0 at half time, and then they brought Bale on off the bench, and you saw him warming up, and you're like, all right then, like, yeah, okay. Let's see what you're all about. And I'm not being funny. His first touch, he had three touches and he'd already set up a goal. The ball got pinged out to him. He took a touch, took another touch, put a cross in with the outside of his left foot, and they scored from it. And you're like, okay, fair enough. Like, he literally just walked onto the pitch and created a goal. And he nearly scored the second. Keeper saved it. Rebound went in. We were 2-1 down. And we eventually scored an equaliser in the 93rd, 94th minute and ended up drawing 2-2 away. Unfortunately, we'd lost the first leg 2-0, so we went out. But it was a really good game, and we gave a really good account of ourselves, which was really fun.
How did you deal with like the communication aspect? As you know, as being a goalkeeper, where sort of communication is such a crucial sort of part of the game, like with the Spanish struggling with like being very new to the language, what was the kind of tricks or like tips or things that you kind of worked on?
So I was very fortunate that pretty much the only person that spoke English at the club was my goalkeeper coach. So I was very lucky that the person that I was working alongside most had a good understanding of English. And one of the first things I did was I said, right, I'm going to write down a list of all the words that I use in English when I'm trying to communicate as a goalkeeper. And we'll sit down together and we'll try and translate them as close as possible. There was some that he didn't understand what I was talking about, but the majority of them we managed to kind of cross-translate very quickly. So those were the words that I'd learn first, and I'd try and use them as much as possible to get into my head. But then,
do you still
once
remember some of them?
Oh yeah, no, I can still speak them.
With like, I have it.
Keepers.
Well, I know that's one thing which is quite interesting, because people now who might watch my videos and watch me train, they often ask when I'm coming to take the cross what I'm saying. Because I don't say keepers, and they can't work out what I'm saying. And I actually use my name. I say Connors when I come and take a cross. And a lot of people go, why do you say your name? And it came from that, because I thought, rather than me saying something that they don't understand, keepers, or just actually saying portero, which is the word for goalkeeper, but no one uses it, I was like, well, I'll just use my name, because then everyone knows it's me. So from then, I've always used my name when I'm coming for crosses, in case whatever country I play in, people don't understand what I'm talking about. So things like that, there are little kind of idiosyncrasies that you pick up from.
It's quite a clever also psychological tip also for people to sort of remember your name and
Yeah, I guess. Also something self-confident, yeah, right? You exactly. Just call your name, go out there, go grab it. And yeah, very cosmopolitan, as you say, right? It works everywhere, so.
Mm. Yeah.
Good trick. Anything else, though, that was different towards you training as a goalie in England? In comparison to maybe Sweden later on, but also Spain. What's going on?
Yeah.
We're struggling with the Spanish today. Spain?
The big difference in the goalkeeping kind of focus was the goalkeeping that I had experienced in England, which was lower football league kind of level. I wasn't at a Premier League club, so I'm sure it would have been different. But there was a lot of focus on athleticism, on speed, on power, on strength, all that side of the game, kind of very direct play, making sure you're strong, coming through bodies, taking balls, that kind of thing. Moved to Spain, and the physical element was hardly there. There wasn't many times that we would train in the gym as a team. Even with our goalkeeping, there wasn't much based on the physical. It was massively focused on the technical aspect. So on positioning, on handling, on footwork, obviously, distribution, first touch, all that kind of stuff. So when I trained in Spain and I'd see the goalkeepers kind of meandering around and taking it easy, and I'd be like, right, I'm going to blast them. I'd go in. I was like, I'm going to go in. I'm going to be so fast, so powerful, so athletic. And the goalkeeper coach says to me, he's like, it's great that you can do that, but that then means that you're kind of half a yard off with your positioning, or your handling not quite right because you're rushing everything through. So we almost had to rebuild that kind of technical aspect to partner it with the physical stuff that I learned from England. And it fits very well with Sweden now, because Sweden is not as technically focused as Spain, but it's not as physically kind of important in terms of the elements of your game as England is. It's not as direct, it's not as powerful, it's not as aggressive. It's almost in between the two. So the two kind of schools of goalkeeping that I've been fortunate to learn from seem to pair quite well with what the kind of Swedish way of playing football is in what I'm experiencing at the moment.
And so at what point did you begin the vlog? Was it long before the experience in Spain, or had you been doing it?
It was pretty much as I was going to Spain. It was that summer. So that was when I'd had the whole driving around, trying to find teams. And I was in pre-season training with the first club I was at, which was a club called Rayo Vallecano, before Fuenlabrada. And I kind of thought to myself, this is a really weird way of getting a club. This is a really kind of interesting story. When I was a kid, I would have loved to have seen someone going abroad and trying to play, and like how to get a club if you didn't have an agent. I thought, why don't I just kind of start documenting the whole process that I'm going through? Because hopefully that can bring value to other keepers that might be at that point or might come to that point at some point in their careers. So that's when we started doing Keeping Goals in that summer, which was 2017.
Yeah. And what was the initial feedback that you got? Was it enthusiasm right from the get-go?
It was funny because, I mean, the first vlog I ever did, I'm sure people probably go and watch it after I say this, but the first vlog I ever did, I was terrible on camera. Like, you can literally see how petrified I was to sit in front of the camera and talk.
Although it was just you, right? There was no one behind the camera, right?
It wasn't even a camera. It was my phone. I bought a little
phone. Just terrified of it.
Yeah, I filmed it with my phone. The whole of series one of Keeping Goals is filmed on my phone. So I'm umming and ahhing. I don't know what to say. Like, I feel I'm really stiff. I'm really awkward. And it's the same as anything. When you first try something, you're terrible at it. And I think the first vlog I put out, I had a lot of people coming and watching it because it was all my mates from school. It was all the people from uni. Like, it was all the people like, oh, what's Connor doing? Like, why is he making a video? Like, that's a bit weird. And so, like, the first vlog actually had loads of views because, like, all these people wanted to see what I was doing. Like, the second, third, fourth carrying on had, like, nothing because no one was very interested in it. But slowly over time, kind of, the quality of what I was doing on it got better. The quality of the editing that we did got better. But also we tried to bring value with every episode, either kind of showing what's happening with me or kind of trying to teach something that I'm learning from my goalkeeping or whatever. But each episode, we tried to help people as much as possible in some way. And over time, fortunately, I mean, we were never focused on the views or the numbers. It wasn't important. But over time, we seemed to have kind of really helped a lot of people and a lot of goalkeepers, which is amazing.
Yeah. Have you ever had any sort of issue with the clubs that you've been at with maybe some feedback or like them being, who does this guy think he is? Or
yeah,
you don't want
I mean,
to
I think
the, in the, club?
The first vlog in Spain, I think I've talked about this before, but in Spain, the first time I was making the videos, like I didn't want to make it in and around the club because obviously you're trying to be professional. And I almost kind of convinced anyone that ever saw that I was filming, even just my own personal stuff. I was like, oh, I'm just making a project for school. Like, you don't really want to talk about it, like all that kind of stuff. But going through as I've kind of gone on, you know when you know when it's appropriate to film stuff and when it's not appropriate. First and foremost, I'm trying to be a professional footballer. I am a professional footballer now, thankfully, and that's your job. You don't want to jeopardize that. You'd never reveal anything that wasn't supposed to be public. You'd never kind of put any team meetings or team notes out or anything like that. But I think over time, people have realized that the whole point of it is not self-promotion. It's not me trying to make myself look good. It's an honest documentation of when I'm playing well, but also when I'm playing badly, when I've been man of the match or goalkeeper of the year, and when I've conceded five or been injured. I'm trying to document the whole process to bring as much value to people as possible. And I think the clubs, I've been fortunate so far that every club I've been to has seen how much it helps other people. And I'm sure they've also seen that it has potential to help them as a club as well, spreading what they're doing. So I've been very lucky that they've been very kind of cooperative with what I'm trying to do with it.
Also, the vlog also goes beyond the just assessing your performance, right? And your technique. Mm. I mean, that's an essential part of it. But I felt that sometimes it was also a football lifestyle blog where you not just talk about the training, but also what you eat, what you do, what your expectations are of in your country. And I think this symbiosis of these two things getting together is something that's very interesting, I guess, to a lot of viewers.
Yeah, I think, because that means that also people that maybe aren't interested in goalkeeping itself still find it interesting, like you say, being in different countries, pursuing a dream career, all those kind of elements of it. And the honesty and the kind of the showing the real process of that is important, because as everyone knows, it's not all kind of sunshine and rainbows when you're trying to chase what you want to do. There are some hard bits, so hopefully that kind of means that even people that aren't interested in goalkeeping still get some value from it.
Yeah, and it makes you think of your own Sunday matches in the amateur leagues, right? Like when you wake up and then you try to eat like a proper meal, drink enough to get ready, do some stretches, you know, you get in the mood, put your backpack on and then you go off. I think that feels very close, you know, even though you can't relate to the performance or the level of play, of course, but the rituals are more or less the same, I guess, across...
Yeah, and the feeling, I think... At the same time, like, people see when it's a build up to a big game and you're naturally nervous and you're kind of excited and you're waiting to play. Like, everyone's been in that position, whatever sport they're into. So, yeah, I think there's definitely elements to relate, of course, to anyone at any level. That's something that we've always tried to make it. We don't want to make it an elite thing, because it's not. It's the normal process of trying to do what you want to do.
Do you ever have days where you just slack and you're not as efficient in your training? Because it always feels like, you know, the mere mortals play, sit at home, play the Xbox every now and then, you know, and then go to training twice a week.
No,
and
with
you,
I do.
I've got my protein intake, you know, I did my stretching and now, you know, I'm off to learning some Swedish.
I mean, I do. I, of course, like everyone, of course I do. But the... I mean, I think I'm also very aware how much it shines a light on how boring it must seem to everyone else in terms of the daily process and the daily kind of weekly schedule. Because the most recent vlog I did was literally my training session, my training schedule for a full week. And halfway through, I said, I know you guys must be bored of this by now, because it's literally wake up, go to gym, come back, have some food, go to training, go to sleep. And for someone that doesn't love it, that must be really, really boring. But for me, I really enjoy that. I love playing football every day. I love going to the gym. I love eating the same lunch that I've had for about 8 months in a row and whatever it is. it shows you that, obviously, when you see the top players and the cars and the money and the house, that's what you think of when it comes to footballers. But that's the 1%. The rest of the kind of people still playing football, they have to live that life all the time. And for most people, they probably wouldn't want to swap with them, because it can be very boring. But for me, thankfully, I enjoy doing it.
So after your studies, you went and played in Gibraltar. How did these sort of opportunities come up? Did people contact you, or do you sort of have to proactively sort of put your name out? Oh, I'm interested in playing here, or how does?
I've always had to kind of chase the opportunities. Even I think this winter was the first time that I had a club that wanted me, because it was Petia that I'd just won the league with and they wanted me to stay. That was the first time that I'd had a club be like, right, we want you for next season.
What a feeling.
There's something wrong with them.
Yeah, and it's not like, I mean, it's not the kind of no one wants you. It's a massive space of everyone in the world and everyone trying to be footballers and everyone trying to find links. And for whatever reason, I mean, I finished at Fuenlabrada because I had to go back and finish my final year at Loughborough. I finished my final year at Loughborough. You can't carry on at university anymore. You need to go and try and find a job or a club or whatever you want to do. So I go and play in Gibraltar. And that came from literally trying to secure an opportunity wherever, back in Spain, in England, and kind of through contacting lots of agents, lots of clubs, lots of goalkeeper coaches. There's kind of, you suddenly get murmurs sometimes of, oh, these guys might need a goalkeeper, or these guys might need a goalkeeper. At times I've been thinking that I'm going to Scotland or coming to England or going back to Spain or Gibraltar, or I've even had ones where it's like, oh, you could maybe find somewhere in Venezuela. And it's like, it could end up anywhere. So as soon as the opportunities come, you kind of have to assess it quite quickly and go, do you fancy it? And you go, yeah, let's go for it. You go and give it a go. And hopefully that then leads to another opportunity. With Gibraltar, we were halfway through, well, two thirds of the way through the season when the kind of coronavirus stuff happened. The league was suspended and then cancelled. So I came back to England and no one knew how that league was going to go. And then I had to try and find a new place to play that was still playing football. And Sweden was kind of one of those only countries that was still going. And fortunately, Petia, well, unfortunately for the other lads, but Petia had had some injuries to goalkeepers. They needed someone to come in. So for me, who was sitting at home, well, training at home in lockdown one, it was like, yep, yeah, get me out there. So then you're back out again and you're after somewhere new. So these opportunities, they can come like that and you just have to be kind of ready to take them.
You have to sort of just, like once there's the initial contact, you have to sort of show them all your clips and stuff. Like, this is my repertoire and stuff and this is what I'm capable of. And then like, how quickly can it go after the process?
Yeah, so I mean, you can... contact? What I tell a lot of people that ask me that type of question is it's always important to have your kind of football CV like you would with a normal job application. Have your football CV, like your kind of your main achievements, where you've played, recommendations, all that kind of stuff. Then have your football highlight video, so recent highlights from your games, the different areas of your games which are hopefully beneficial to other teams. And you can actively push that out. I've actively kind of pushed that to scouts and agents and managers on LinkedIn, on email, on even writing letters like we did, putting in golden envelopes. You just have to actively push it. And then once you kind of see that someone's interested or there's an opportunity somewhere, you have the kind of initial conversations, you figure out if it's kind of in the best interests of both parties. And then normally you have to make a decision pretty quick, because if you don't want to do it, they'll need to find another goalkeeper. So you kind of have to almost just hold your breath and jump and go for it, and hopefully it's a good decision.
Do you think your vlog helps with creating like this opportunity structure, or people can do like a more thorough research on you and look what you're up to, where you've actually been?
Yeah. I mean, I think the vlog, I've always understood that it's a good opportunity for me to kind of build my reputation as a goalkeeper. It allows me to showcase myself to more people. And hopefully either that is someone that can get benefit from it for themselves, a younger goalkeeper or whoever, but it might also be a manager or a scout or a agent. And I know that it's a good place for me to put up my highlight videos on YouTube as well, so people can see it. And you never know kind of who sees what, and you just have to make sure that, as always, you're professional with it, you're doing it for the right reasons. But I think there's no doubt that it helps to have more eyes on you to show what you can do. And then if that leads to opportunities, then brilliant.
Yeah.
But did you realise how big a sort of change it would be from playing in sort of sunny Gibraltar to so north? It's like such a polar opposite.
Yeah, I mean, when I arrived in July, the summers here get pretty warm. So the summers can get up to 30 degrees here in Pitia. So I kind of turned up with my big coat thinking it was going to be freezing, and it was almost as warm as where it was in Gibraltar. But now that we're in January, you kind of realize the difference between the two. And I think, well, it's benefited me in one way, because I mean, the first pre-season that I did in Madrid, it got to 39, 40 degrees when we were training, and it was just like an oven. Whereas the other week it was minus 27 and we're training here in Pitia. So I kind of know that I can still train and perform at those different ends of the spectrum. So I'm like, well, anything in between is easy now.
Are all the pitches that you're playing on in Sweden, are they all sort of the 4G Astra?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, even up to the top division here in Sweden, the majority of clubs are all on AstroTurf. And it was actually quite similar in Spain. Probably from the third division down, everyone was on AstroTurf, but it was for very different reasons. In Spain, it was because you couldn't afford the water to keep it wet all the time. Whereas in Sweden, like you say, with the snow, you can't, the damage that it would do to grass is quite big. So in terms of us, we train and we play pretty much exclusively on AstroTurf here.
Do you find you need to adjust some of sort of like your processes and also like the way you sort of approach when you're playing on the different surfaces? Like, what are some of the things you've had to change?
I think I've probably probably since I was about 22, I've probably mainly trained and on AstroTurf the majority of the time. I mean, even at Loughborough, we were training on AstroTurf. We had an amazing grass pitch at Loughborough. And obviously the surface is different in terms of how the ball moves on it, how it skips off, your kind of decision-making process. But Spain was mainly AstroTurf. Gibraltar was mainly AstroTurf. Sweden's been mainly AstroTurf. So most of the time I've been training and playing on Astro. So I think if I ever end up somewhere that's grass again, you'll probably have to make that adjustment back to that type of football. But it's all about kind of the speed of decision-making, tracking the ball, making sure you're switched on, because it doesn't play too different, especially if it's a good quality AstroTurf.
I did want to ask you about playing in Gibraltar, because forgive me if I'm wrong, all the games or all teams, their home stadium is like the National Gibraltar Stadium. Did that ever get like very weird if you're like, oh, we're at home this week, oh, we're away this week?
Yeah. So basically, like, there was only 12 teams in the league. We all played on the same stadium because Gibraltar's tiny. For anyone that knows Gibraltar, it's pretty much like a rock on the end of Spain with a big city, which is Gibraltar. I think maybe 30,000 people. That's about it. So in terms of us all playing on the stadium, yeah, if you were home or away, the only difference was which changing room you went into. So you're kind of not sure where you were getting changed. But the stadium itself is incredible. It's you'll have to have a look on and kind of Google. But behind one goal, you've got the Rock of Gibraltar, which is kind of very iconic, like very kind of awe-inspiring. So if you're at that end looking that way, it looks amazing. But behind the other goal is the runway for the airport. So you can be taking a goal kick and the Boeing 747's landing behind you. You kind of have to keep your concentration. So it's a very unique place to play football, but definitely one that I'll remember because it is a very kind of iconic and amazing stadium.
Yeah. What was the standard like in Gibraltar? Was it much different from what you've been used to playing in before?
The difference in Gibraltar was the variation in terms of quality. So even though there was, like I say, 12 teams, you have the top teams who consistently, because being the top teams, are in Champions League qualification, Europa League qualification, have good money, can bring in really good Spanish players or really good British players or European players. And then the bottom teams in Gibraltar are almost kind of like local sides made up of mates that want to play together and very, very small budgets. So it's not uncommon that if you have the top team play the bottom team, you can get a 12-0, 13-0. Like, it's a ridiculous kind of differentiation in terms of standard. But the good teams with the good players have some really, really top quality players. So it was each week something different was kind of showing itself. But it was a good experience. And I mean, I was kind of in teams which were around the middle of the pack. And as a goalkeeper, especially when you play against the top teams, you know you're in for a busy day. So in that sense, it's whether you win, lose or draw, you know that you're going to have the opportunity to test yourself. So it was a good challenge in that sense.
What was the worst result you had while you played for your team in Gibraltar?
The worst result in Gibraltar was 5-0.
Oh, that's not even close to Nicky Salapu. <Yeah.
laughs> we had one game where we played Europa, who, when the league was suspended, were top of the league. They were going to win the league. Yeah, so we played Europa, and this was as Europa Point, the first club that I was with, which was pretty much one of the bottom teams, had brought in loads of new players just to try and build a good squad. And the last time that Europa Point played Europa, they'd lost 11-0. And we played Europa, we lost 1-0. And I come off the pitch and I was fuming. You've lost, like you're gutted, you're upset. Like the owners coming down and they're going mad. They're like, that was amazing. Like, it was like that was incredible. Like everyone's going berserk. Like all the locals, like, oh, that's amazing. That's like all of us are like, we just lost. Like, why is everyone so happy? And they're like, oh yeah, last time we played them, we lost 11-0. So that's brilliant. And we were like, right, okay. So like those type of things you're kind of not used to. But yeah, really interesting experience either way.
Once we had Nicky Salapu on, and he is the goalie. He used to be the goalie for American Samoa, and they famously have the biggest FIFA game loss ever in football history, which was 31-0 to Australia. And there's this one picture where he just, you know, lies in baby pose on the pitch, and you can see that it's just, you know, that was one too many. And then we had him on and we talked about this, and he said that the one wish he has in his football career was that he would get to play against Australia one more time, you know, to redeem himself a bit.
I mean, there's the fact that you're even at the level where you're playing against Australia, you kind of go, wow, fair enough. Like, whatever happens, you go, that's some experience. But yeah, I feel for him that as a goalkeeper, especially because there's not much you can do. I'm sure he probably made about 15 saves as well. So it's a tough one.
Why a goalie though? That was I meant to ask this question at the beginning. When did you know that a goalie was your calling? That was the position.
I always enjoyed playing in goal, mainly because my younger brother, who's only about 18 months younger than me. He always loved playing outfield and he loved shooting and I loved jumping around and saving. So from probably about the ages of 4 and 3, we'd be out in the garden and he'd just kick it at me and I'd try and jump in the way of it. And that still goes on to today. Like even when I go back home and he's back home with me, we'll go to the park and we'll just spend hours him just kicking a ball and me trying to save it. And that was really the beginning of it. And I enjoyed that feeling of making a save and jumping around. So yeah, I think if... a lot of people that go start off in goal, they don't realize the downsides of the position. I think that upside of making saves kind of definitely outweighs all of that stuff.
Yeah, I did want to talk about sort of the psychological aspect of sort of being a goalkeeper. So something that's kind of always fascinated me is how you deal with making a mistake as a goalkeeper, because when you're outfield and like some the ball runs under your foot or something, you can immediately get on the ball or something and it's fine. And somebody who's sort of at our very junior level of seven-a-side is converted to playing in goal, I've found very interesting to try and deal with, like, psychologically how you deal in the minutes after you make a mistake.
Yeah, the psychological and the mental side of goalkeeping, I think, can make or break a goalkeeper. It can be your biggest attribute or your biggest weakness. And I think it's a shame that it's that way because, like you say, a centre midfielder give away the ball 10 times, no one will talk about it. If you're a goalkeeper and you misplace a pass, then everyone's going to talk about it. Or if the ball goes through your hands and same with a striker, you miss 6 good chances and you score 1, no one worries. Yeah, as a goalkeeper, you make 6 saves and you let one in that maybe you shouldn't have done and everyone's pointing the finger. So it's just the culture of football, especially I think in the British game. But for me personally, I think you're always going to make a mistake. Mistakes will come. And you kind of have to, in the moment, almost blanket and reset and start again, because the worst thing you can do is get stressed and get worked up about it, because that very often leads to a second one. And then you're on a downward spiral and you're in a really difficult place. So if you can master the art of parking it, at least for the rest of the game, starting afresh and each action, just concentrating on it 100%, one at a time, then you can build a good game. And then after the game, go back and look at it, because mistakes are data rich. They're the best opportunities for you to learn things. So as a goalkeeper, again, it's an opportunity for you to grow. So it's a relationship that has taken me a long time to build. There's definitely been stages that I've been kind of very anxious about mistakes or frustrated by them. But over time and with experience, you kind of learn to live with the process of them happening and know that they will happen. And it's about how you bounce back from it and deal with it going forward.
Yeah, more zen approach.
Exactly.
But that's also what stands out, I think, from your vlog. You seem to have a very thorough and maybe research-based approach to problems and challenges. And then to take them and see them as opportunities to grow, maybe as a person, but also as a sportsman. So
yeah. And I mean, that's probably something that I benefited from having other areas of my life that I was interested in. I think it can be quite dangerous if you're solely focused on football and everything about you is in that moment, because if you put yourself on a pedestal as I am a goalkeeper, I am a footballer, and things are going wrong, suddenly not only do you have an issue in terms of trying to sort that out, you also kind of start having an identity crisis of what am I if I'm not very good at this? So the fact that I've always been interested in studying or doing different things or learning about other stuff, it's almost translated into my goalkeeping that I like researching different stuff. I like trying to play with different elements of developing. And it's almost, I take an active interest in that development process. That's something that I enjoy doing. And even if it goes wrong on a weekend, I'll have a day where I'm annoyed about it and I'll be home and I'll be frustrated or whatever. But then you get up and you go again and you keep trying to move forward with it. So I think that's something I've learned by having different elements of my life that isn't, oh, I've got to be the best goalkeeper and that's all that I do. Like, it's important to have those other aspects.
So moving on to your time at Pidia now, what is it like? What is life like for you in the town now? Are you like the only sort of foreign player at the club, or what's the?
Yeah, so I mean, there were five of us that were from the UK that were playing for Pidia last year. Wait, so we had five English lads. Yeah, and there are a lot of English lads playing. Well, that were playing at kind of all different levels in Sweden. Is probably the most I've ever seen in terms of exported English players. When I was in Spain, there was hardly any. But in Pidia, we had a few. But then because of Brexit this year, there's been a lot of issues in terms of UK nationals now having to have work permits. There's a kind of minimum salary for a non-EU worker, which is very high, and all that kind of stuff. So I was very fortunate that I have Irish citizenship as well as British citizenship. So I'm still an EU player. So I was able to come back, but all these English lads haven't been able to come back. So now we have a lad who's Portuguese that's playing in Pidia, but the rest at the moment are all Swedish. So and a lot of local lads from the town, which is only a small town. But thankfully, having been here almost 6 months now, I now have quite a good relationship with obviously the players and the staff and people within the town that know that I play for the club, and it's starting to feel more like home, which is nice.
Yeah, because I read that the football team is quite sort of strong and well supported in the town. I know that the women's team is quite upright. They play in the top division.
Yeah, so the women's team are very good. The women's team are in the top league in Sweden. They won that league in 2018, and we're in the Champions League as a result. Like, they're a very good team, the women's team. And I think traditionally the women's team have had a greater support within the town than the men's team, because obviously playing at that level. Last year with the men's team, we had a very successful year too, winning the league and getting promotion. So it's quite a nice period of time with the town having the two teams doing really well. So hopefully we can keep getting those promotions and catch them up, and we can make Pidia as successful on both sides. But it's nice to have a small town where two teams are doing really well on both sides, male and female, which is quite unique.
And in Sweden, are there fans in the stadium at all at the moment, or is it still all behind?
We had last season when we were playing, there was a cap, so we were only allowed, I think it was 50 fans in to watch. It was better than nothing. It was nice to have people there supporting, but yeah, it was unfortunate that we couldn't have everyone come to it. I'm not sure what's happening with this season yet. Some of the clubs that we're playing against this season are big clubs with big stadiums. So it'd be great if everyone's allowed back in, if we can play in some full stadiums down, especially down south in Stockholm and things like that. But yeah, we'll see.
Sorry, I have to go back to the Irish thing.
I was so surprised that you skipped this. Like television.
Where is the connection? This is when I find out that my mom probably knows whoever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Connor O'Keefe is a pretty self-explanatory name. On my dad's side, I got a lot of family over in Ireland, so Dublin, Wexford, Cork. Like my granddad is Irish. And he came over to the UK when he was younger, and so from that sense we have that Irish kind of heritage. But yeah, no, I love Ireland, and I haven't been back for a while, but I do need to go back soon and see everyone because it's an amazing place.
Yeah, no, I'm from Cork, so Cork is the place.
Oh, brilliant! Yeah. Well, sure. You might, I don't know if you'll know it, but the village that my granddad's from is Carrick na Mhaire, which is not too far from Cork itself, but it's tiny. Like, if you don't know it, it's a tiny, it's probably about four farms.
I was disappointed. I'm from like very west country Cork, so not near the city. So
yeah, well, there you go. But
what a letdown.
No, Cork, yeah. Cork's well, a great place.
I should have just lied. Yeah, actually, my mom and dad.
Your mom's not gonna like this.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But it must be like thinking about sort of your future plans to have an EU passport. You know, just because I imagine the sort of unknowing of sort of losing that sort of opportunity.
And I mean, that was one of the first things as soon as the kind of vote happened in 2016, my whole family then were like, right, let's get this sorted. Because I mean, even for myself, knowing, even back then, knowing what I wanted to do and knowing that there was probably a strong possibility that I'd have to go abroad at some point and play, is I think the implications, I'm not sure the UK are fully aware, especially for people trying to work abroad and things like that, how difficult it's going to get. So yeah, I'm very fortunate in that sense that I have the family enabled to do that. So yeah, it's a stroke of fortune for myself with that one.
So what are the aims for sort of the club and for yourself this year, having been, you know, newly promoted from the lower division? Is it sort of just survival at first thing, or what is the kind of, is that the discussion around?
Yeah,
it?
I mean, I think last year we were almost tipped to be bottom half last year, and we ended up winning the league. I think this year automatically everyone goes, oh, quite a small club going up to that level, you're going to struggle, you're going to be trying to play for promotion. In my head, it's the same attitude of, well, they can think that, but we're going to do as well as we can and see and play as high and try and finish as high as possible. Whether that'll be promotion again or whether that'll be just staying up, whatever it is kind of in between, we want to give everyone a kind of showing of what we can do as a team. And I think we'll be in a really good position once the season starts to do that. So I'm excited to test ourselves against some of the clubs that we'll be coming up against. So it should be good fun.
Yeah, how soon does the season start, right? Because you're in pre-season now and then.
Yeah, quite a long time. The pre-season here is very long. So our first league game is actually on the 4th of April. So we're in pre-season January, February, March. And then the first league game is away against Dalkurd, who are quite a big club. They were in the Allsvenskan probably 2-3 years ago. So that's quite a tasty one to start off with. But it'll be interesting. I've not done a pre-season this long before. So it's about kind of tempering yourself that you don't peak too soon. You don't want to be kind of, especially emotionally and all that sense, you don't want to be chomping at the bit 1st of February and then still have 2 months to go before the game. So you're trying to,
all hyped up.
You're trying to build into it.
Yeah, true. How do you do this though? Because that's what you said, right? Even in Spain, you were so all in, trying to make every training count. How do you restrain yourself?
Like, I've always, my best seasons have always been ones where I've gone in and gone straight off the bat. Like, even with Petia, I came in and they'd already had two league games. And because of coronavirus, the league had been halved. So instead of 26 games, there was 13 games for a season. And it was almost like a sprint to the end. 13 games, anyone can win it. So we'd already had two games when I came in. There was only 11 left. And I was like, right, just drop in at 100% and go all out. And we have a great, we had a great year. And those 11 games, we kept 8 clean sheets and won the league. So for me now, I'm naturally someone that loves to kind of just go and give as much as I can straight away. And people will see that from how I train and things like that. But especially emotionally and mentally at the minute, I keep having to make sure that you're building everyone up. You're trying to encourage, you're trying to keep everyone calm and focused rather than 100% energy. And then I'm sure as we're getting in towards March and closer to April, I'll take the tapers off it and we'll go all out.
And do you, have you still got some sort of like long-term goals of maybe trying to play at a highest level possible in England, or is it, are you still sort of pursuing this adventure of abroad, or do you just like not think about the long-term thing and just try and take it by game and season by season?
I do think of the long-term, and there's goals that I'll set. I'm conflicted in a way because I love what I do in terms of having the ability to travel around and see different places and meet different people, all whilst doing something that I love, which is playing football. That's a dream lifestyle for anyone, really. But inside, I still have the drive to, especially back home in England, to come back and play at the highest level I possibly can. And the pathway for me to do that is to keep progressing and to keep learning and to keep building my reputation, whether that's abroad. And then when it's ready, and I think there will be a time where it's ready and the opportunity there, come back at the highest level you can and show everything that you've learned in this almost kind of apprenticeship that you've done abroad and come back and perform as best as possible back home. So I'm sure that will happen at some point. But at the moment, I am enjoying traveling around, moving up the leagues, showing what I can do, learning different cultures and seeing different places at the same time. So I can't complain. It's been a great ride so far. So hopefully it'll keep going.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it.
Why do you think that? Because I think you spoke about, obviously, there was a few English players playing with you in Pedia, but like broadly, there's sort of the perception that British players don't want to try and travel and play abroad and unlike other places, like nationalities and stuff. Why do you think that is? Do you think that's just purely down to sort of language stuff or something culturally about maybe British football?
I think the language is a big thing. I think the fact that you'll know this, obviously, Liam, the fact that a lot of other countries, you are learning your languages from a very young age. In England, you have your French lessons, but no one really kind of gives it that much. And the ability to speak languages is very poor overall. I think that is an element of it. I think another element is the fact that we grow up being told that our league is the best league in the world. And every kid wants to play in that league. And they almost kind of have the ingrained mentality of, well, if I'm not getting there, then what's the point? And they throw it in and they go and do something else. Whereas I say to people, like, look at the Brazilians that are playing in Ukraine in order to just try and get an opportunity in Europe. You travel halfway across the world somewhere that you've never heard of before. You can't speak the language just to try and get the chance. So I think it's definitely something that more British players should look at, because yes, the Premier League's amazing and there's some brilliant teams in England, but there's a lot of football cultures where you can develop and learn things abroad that you wouldn't be able to learn at home. And it'll only add to your game as a player. And the better you are, the more opportunities you'll get. So for me, to try and learn those things and develop is a great opportunity to reach the level that I want to get to.
Well, I'm trying to think. I think it's somewhat similar in Germany. Yeah. I don't think there are lots of German players, especially in the youth squads, that go abroad a lot. Like in comparison to other countries, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's also to do with like the markets, right? There's a lot of money in English football, like which goes quite deep, and then people are more reticent to try and experience somewhere else.
But then, the money's a good point. Like if you're a championship player or a League One player, and you're maybe not playing, you're kind of on the fringes, you're earning a lot more there than you would be at an equivalent level, even in Spain or Portugal or someone like that. So, are you willing to take a 80% pay cut to go and play somewhere abroad? And a lot of people aren't. So it's another good point. But I think the big leagues where you're told this is the best league to be in, everyone wants to stay there. So, but at the same time, everyone's coming there from abroad. So you have to kind of figure a way through all that competition.
So I think, yeah, I think that brings me up across everything that we wanted to cover. Thank you so much for...
Wait, one question.
It's not everything we wanted to cover.
No, definitely not. So, because, you know, since I moved to Copenhagen, I haven't really played a lot of football, but then I found this one club and Alex plays there as well. And he's recently somewhat transitioned to the role of a goalkeeper. So now, of course, I have to ask for the sake of Volvox. Not that he's doing a bad job, not at all. But, you know, just to improve his game, now that you're here, what is the number one tip for goalie in the amateur league?
Just to let you know at what level I'm at, the first thing that I had to struggle with for the first couple of games is when the player is at the other end of the field, making sure that I'm standing in the middle of the goal.
the middle of the goal, you laugh, but the middle of the goal is important. Like even when we train and for whatever reason we move the goals out the area, so you don't have the penalty spot, you don't have the markings, I will still mark with my foot in the AstroTurf where the middle of the goal is, because it's very important. You base everything off that. So obviously knowing the middle of the goal helps. I would also say go for absolutely everything, whether it's a dive, whether it's a foot save, whether it's a whatever, because a lot of the times you stop yourself going in your head. You think, oh, I'd never get there. And if you just throw caution to the wind and go for it, somehow your fingertip will hit it, or it'll hit your big toe and it'll go out and you'll be like, how on earth did I save that? And that's normally just because you've kind of gone, oh, never mind, I'm just going to go for it, and you somehow make a save. So I always say just go for absolutely everything. If it goes in, it goes in, but at least you'll have no regrets of not diving for it.
Yeah, Connor, I say far more with my feet than with my hands. Which I'm starting to think.
That's all right. That
sounds like quality advice. I'm going to send you some footage, like a montage of Alex going for everything and see how it goes.
I'd like to see that. Give me with that one.
All right.
Cool.
So thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It's been really, really interesting, and we've had a good time.
No, not at all. I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
And yeah, good luck with everything for the season, and I encourage everyone to check out Connor's vlog, Keeping Goals, on YouTube, and also follow him on social media.
Podcast Network.